Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Easter weekend edition of Talking Twilight Zone. I'm sorry, Talking Twilight Zone. And I hope you enjoy this episode. This is going to be a classic episode, so I hope you all enjoy it. And here we go.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Okay, everybody. Well, as I said, we're here at our Easter weekend edition of Talking Twilight Zone, and I welcome everyone who's here, and I would like to turn this over now to our main moderator, Mr. Bobby Neer.
Thanks, Lynn, and let me, on behalf of myself and all my co-moderators, wish everyone a very happy Easter Sunday tomorrow. On our last program 2 weeks ago, we had to face down two of the low light moments of the series. One thing about Twilight Zone is that if you wait long enough, something special is bound to come along that will get your attention, and that is what we have on tap today as we take on a classic episode people are alike all over, in which an American astronaut finds out not only that there is life out there in the vast reaches of outer space, but that they share some unique human qualities as well, much to his everlasting regret. So please allow me to turn this back over to Lynn, the very personification of the cutest Easter bunny, for her summary and review of this episode. Okay, hon, hop to it.
Okay, sweetie. Well, people are alike all over. Starts out with Sam Conrad and his friend Warren Markison looking at the rocket ship that they're going to board the next day to visit the planet Mars. Sam tells Markison that he's very afraid because he's being sent there for his mind, because he's a scientist. But Markison apparently has flown these flights before, or at least he's, at the very least, he's an astronaut. Markison tells Sam not to worry because people are basically the same on any planet. Sam still seems skeptical. He doesn't believe all this. Well, the ship does hit Mars, but it crash lands. Warren Markison is barely alive, but wants to see what's outside of the ship. Sam Conrad doesn't want to look because the knocking sound he keeps hearing outside, the knocking sound he hears outside of the ship. His friend Markison dies before Sam finally decides to open the door of the ship and venture outside. When Sam finally does open the door, he sees a bunch of people wearing Roman-type togas, but doesn't question that because he's just thrilled to see actual people and not aliens. He even says to them, "You're people, just like me." But they actually weren't. They really weren't. However, they did offer to properly bury Markison. They were not out to harm Sam, but they meant to keep him. They brought him to a house similar to the house he lived in by reading his mind and thoughts. They put the house together in one night. Sam had excellent, even cigarettes and excellent scotch in that house. It was obvious that Sam was attracted to Tina, played by the very beautiful Susan Oliver. It was also obvious that Tina was not pleased with her clan's intentions for Sam. Well, to make a long but classic story short, sadly, when Sam could not find a way, anyway, out of the house, he tried to open every door and couldn't get it open, he pulled down the curtains and found the entire Martian clan watching him. He was a zoo exhibit, no different from monkeys and other animals that we keep in our own zoos. He picked up the sign in front of his so-called home that said, "Earth creature in his natural habitat. Now, I'm not sure if it said in his native habitat or natural habitat, but I think it said natural habitat. But he was shocked. He was absolutely shocked. And he looked at Tina, and he just couldn't believe it. And Tina looked totally dismayed and ran from the site. And Sam shouts out, "Markison, you were right. People are the same everywhere." I thought this was an outstanding and classic episode and one of the best of the first season. It's a hard episode to forget, and Roddy McDowell, outstanding in his role, and so was Susan Oliver. She didn't do much, but still, just her expressions, her, you know, just the way she acted, and Roddy McDowell's acting and the story are enough to rate this episode as a classic 5 rating for me. So, Kelly, what do you think?
Oh, I definitely agree. The first time I saw this episode was a few years ago on a Twilight Zone marathon on the Sci-Fi Channel, and when I first saw it, I really just had no idea as to where the story was going. I was very much surprised. I would say I was surprised by the ending as Roddy McDowell's character was. And certainly, I think it's certainly one, it kind of feeds into the old saying that it's a lot easier to attract a bee with honey than with anything else, you know, and that's exactly what they did. They flaunted Tina, this beautiful, gorgeous woman, in
right.
front of him. So basically, he was ready to just follow Tina anywhere she walked. It's kind of too bad that she couldn't do anything to stop what was happening. But yeah, I was very surprised, and it was kind of an interesting twist on things, because, you know, you kind of think to yourself, well, what would happen if, you know, an alien crash landed here on our planet? Probably something similar, or maybe something even worse. I mean, if you ever saw the movie Starman with Jeff Bridges, they wanted to capture him and do a lobotomy on him and dissect him.
I remember that movie. Yeah, I remember that movie.
Yeah, so you know, all things considered, Roddy McDowell gets put on display as an exhibit, and you're like, well, I suppose on the one hand, it could have been a whole lot worse for him, but on the other hand, it ain't great. I mean, he's just going to sit there for the rest of his life in a zoo exhibit.
Well,
you know,
they gave him some good scotch.
yes, they did, and I was, but I kept thinking to myself, well, it's great that they gave him some good scotch, but but I noticed when he opened up the refrigerator, I didn't notice any good food in there. I mean, at least give the guy some really good food in the refrigerator.
Well, if they're going to keep him alive, they have to feed him, for God's sake.
Yes, he can't. Man cannot live on scotch alone. So, but yeah, I definitely would give it a classic rating too, because the first time I saw it, I was very surprised by that ending as well. I did not see that coming. What did you think, Ken?
Oh, well, before you, Ken, says anything, I want to thank Dave from England. He just came in, so we'll get to him in a little bit after all of our reviews are over. Go ahead, Ken.
Okay, guys, I have a confession to make before our listening audience. I'm in love. I fell in love today because we are reviewing an episode that has the lovely, gorgeous, and stunning Susan Oliver, who really doesn't...
Ken, you've told us this a million times that you're in love with Susan Oliver.
Is your wife standing there right now?
My wife's in the other room, so she can't hear me. But I first fell in love with her from the Fugitive series. She was in an excellent episode called Never Wave Goodbye, 1963. So if anyone can get a chance, you can go to the internet, find that episode, and just watch it, and you will just be bowled over by her presence and by her beauty.
You really want to be bowled over by her. Watch the Star Trek episode, The Cage, where she's got green makeup on and does a sexy dance.
You know what? I have that episode in my library, and I've seen it, called the Menagerie, right?
Well,
yeah.
But you know, yeah, it originally aired as the Menagerie, but then they later reissued it on DVD and video as it originally was supposed to air as the Cage.
Right.
So anyway, but we have digressed. So tell us what you think about this particular episode with Susan Oliver.
What you mean? I can't just talk all about Susan through my review. I have
no.
to talk about the other things too.
No. This episode.
Come on, guys.
All right. Go ahead. Do what you want.
Well, all right. Off into space we go, blasting again for the 7th time, and we're still in the first season. So, Rod Serling, what are you doing? We're going into space again? Come on, there are many areas you can cover. But as I put up with the episode for the first part, you know, Roddy McDowell and Markison's character are in the spaceship. They land, they crash, you hear the knocking, and there's the tension, what's outside. Okay, right away I get the feeling, all right, are there aliens? Are there space creatures? Are there slimy creatures outside? What's it going to be? And so, after the mid-break, we come back and see, you know, normal-looking people with Roman costumes on, watching, and then welcoming Roddy McDowell character, Conrad, the Conrad character, to his planet, bring him back to the house. And the one thing that I was very, very disappointed with Conrad, I would say, Conrad, how could you let Tina... Or Tina, how do you say it?
Tina.
How could he let her go? Remember, she was in the house, and he was in the house. It seems like he has everything. The one thing I would say is, please, guys, just leave Tina with me. We'll get married. We'll have a family, and we'll spend the rest of our life here on this planet, and everything will be fine. But when she left the house, my heart was broken. It really was. And then Roddy McDowell, or Conrad, he's looking all around. There's no windows. Eventually it pops open, and the twist ending. You know, he's captured. He's in a cage, and he can't get out. So this just shows you that in the Twilight Zone series, you don't really need to scare the audience with a slimy-looking monster creature. You know, like Stephen King, we were talking about it earlier, he had a movie called Sleepwalkers, and the high school guy was a normal-looking guy, but at the end of the movie, he turns into this really ugly, slimy monster with his tongue sticking out and his eyes popping out, and Stephen King went for the shock of just scaring the audience to death. Well, Rod Serling in this episode didn't need to do that. He just comes up with the twist and sends a message. People are alike all over. And I have to agree with you guys. I'm going to rate this a classic just for the well-written story, the characters, and really the message. How do we treat other people? And Robert, I'm going to send it to you, but I have a question, and you have to answer this question, Robert, okay? Honestly. If you could go out on a date, would you go out with Inger Stevens from The Hitchhiker or Susan Oliver from this episode?
Or Agnes Moorhead.
No, we'll wait for her later. But Robert, which one? Inger Stevens or Susan Oliver? Come on.
Well, before I answer that question, I'm going to put on what Rod would say about this in the opening.
Oh, Robert, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I always forget the values. Oh,
here it is.
Stop doing that.
That's all right. Go ahead.
And now, Mr. Serling. You're looking at a species of flimsy little two-legged animal with extremely small heads, whose name is Man. Warren Markison, age 35. Samuel A. Conrad, age 31. They're taking a highway into space. Man unshackling himself and sending his tiny groping fingers up into the unknown. Their destination is Mars. And in just a moment, we'll land there with them.
I love how he does that.
Oh, the fingers of the man. He has the sexiest voice. He has the sexiest voice. Oh, Robert, I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay.
I always forget to get your... Oh.
Let me answer Kim's question.
I'm eventually going to get better at that. I'm sorry.
Okay. Susan, actually, I would. But in reality, I would rather take Elizabeth Montgomery later on.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She was hot in that episode, too.
She's beautiful. I'm glad you didn't say Agnes Moorehead.
Maybe in the 30s. Yeah, possibly. But, I kind of put my review out a couple of days ago about people are like Oberyn. And if people who are listening to this show are going to realize it's going to be kind of a love fest with this episode, because I rated this a 4 myself. I thought this was a very well done episode. Roddy McDowall, as we all know, the late Roddy McDowall, wonderful actor. I don't know if a lot of people know that he appeared in the pilot episode of Night Gallery, which years later, Rod Sterling did, and instead of standing in front of a set, he stood in front of a picture gallery and introduced shows. So, but yeah, he was, I think, the second story in the pilot of Night Gallery. But anyway, I just had a couple picks, and I put that in there because you really have to use your imagination on this episode, because, you know, in reality, this was made in the early 1960s, late 1950s, and it kind of relates to, like, the books that kids used to read, the old sci-fi storybooks back in the 30s and 40s. And I made the mention about how the spaceship inside of it kind of looked like something from the old Flash Gordon serials, and them landing on Mars, knowing a science that, you know, you can't breathe in a non-atmosphere. So I came up with the conclusion, I imagine a lot of people did, that there was probably some kind of air bubble protection that were protecting the people on Mars. And maybe the cause of that and the gravitational pull of the planet's what caused the ship to crash. But, I mean, you know, acting-wise, Susan Oliver, I feel she should have had more in this episode, but there again, here it's a 25-minute episode, so you have to spread the love out, you know, to everybody that was there. I thought that Mark, he was kind of a wimp. The Ryan McDowell character.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He should have stood up a little bit more. I don't think he should have been picked for this assignment. There was other episodes in the past that review where we kept wondering how did these people make it through the psych test to get aboard to go.
You do bring up a good point because, you know, actually it seems a little odd that he would be just so trusting of them right away, immediately.
Right.
Because,
right.
I think a standard reaction for a lot of people initially might be, how come they're being so nice to me?
Yeah,
and where are the windows? There's no windows.
No windows in this house.
He doesn't realize it until he has a drink. And then he goes, wait, where's the windows in his mind?
Yeah. And he can't open any of the doors. And he says, this is the best scotch I've ever tasted. And, this is wonderful. You know, with his English accent, you know, he's saying, oh, this is the best scotch I've ever had. And
I wonder how the red sands outside look. What?
There's no
window.
Exactly. But I can't get out of here. Why can't I get out of here? Exactly.
But it's just those minor little things that I mentioned that, I mean, didn't give it a classic for me. It's a little nitpicky stuff, but, you know, it's a great story. I wish it had a little more time to expand itself out. You get to see the fear of the Martian people of why they caged them up towards the end. And
well,
the thing
actually,
is, wearing the togas, too.
Do you think they were in fear of him, or he? I don't think they feared him at all. Do you really?
Yeah,
think
I don't
they feared
think.
Him?
I never got the impression that they were afraid of him. I think they just thought, "Wow, we've got a cool specimen here."
Yeah,
I mean, I think you know, everybody would like to see the Earthman, you know, kind of like back, you know, in the 30s when the Dion quintuplets were born. They just decided, the Canadian government just decided these kids needed to be put on display because everybody should be able to see these kids. And I think it was kind of, I think it was sort of that mentality. It's like, let's parade the Earthman.
Well, I feel they read his mind, because you got to remember, this is the future, and World War II and other things have happened during this time. So I can imagine that they can also, collect the memories of the past as well, and maybe that fear to them, even though it wasn't showed that much, was a cause. It was better for him to be locked up than to be among their people and spread what they would probably call his, you know, infection.
Infection. His thoughts, yeah. You mean his thoughts, maybe the wars that took place and things like that?
Well, humans got the deepest dark side, and maybe that's what they saw, and they didn't want to risk that, and that's why he ended up being a... exhibit.
Yeah, although they never really indicated that was the reason. I mean, that's an interesting point that you bring up, but it would have been more interesting if we had gotten some kind of inkling that was maybe part of their motivation for doing what they did.
That's why
because
I said it's too bad with the 25-minute show.
When you first see them, I mean, you just kind of get the impression that they just want to lock him up just because he'd make a good zoo specimen. Because really, I mean, what about Conrad is so scary? I mean, as far as astronauts go, he's probably the wimpiest astronaut we've seen.
He walks. He walks out of the spaceship. He walks out of the rocket or whatever it is. Not spaceship, but rocket. And he says, "Your people, just like me. You're the same as I am." You're just like me. You're people. And it's like, wow. I mean, they're wearing togas. They're wearing togas, for God's sakes, you know. And he says, but you're people, just like me. And it's like, well, no, they're not really, Sam. You know, look at them. I mean, they don't look like you. They're not dressed like you. So, you know, get a grip.
But maybe at one time they did visit Earth, and maybe they know from experience what Earth is like. Hence, maybe they were one of the original Greek gods.
That's true. Oh, welcome to Rick Wall. Rick,
hello.
It's good to have you here.
Yeah, the reason why they killed them was because people are alike all over, okay? He was different. What do you do with something that's different? You ridicule it, you destroy it, you kill it.
Simple as that. Well, let me pass this on to Bobby, because I hate to steal your thunder again, Bobby, because you said that the last show, so I apologize for taking up the time. But
that's okay.
What'd you think, Bobby?
Well, I don't think that this episode is about Susan Oliver or any of that. I think Rod certainly is trying to make a point here, and you don't need to look any further than the title of the episode, because the suggestion is that, as it is in a lot of Twilight Zone episodes, is that humans have a lot of flaws and a lot of faults. And that even if you go out into the universe, you might find that there are people like us who have the same faults. And that's the problem. I saw this episode for the first time when I was about 13 years old. And even at that age, it took me back when I was about half that age to when I was about 7 years old. I lived in a big city, and my father used to take me to the zoo every now and then. And I loved going to the zoo, and it was all very nice, but one thing that always disturbed me was some of the animals that were caged up. Especially, I can remember they had a beautiful lion in a cage and a beautiful tiger in a cage. And if you stood there and stared at them the way the people on Mars are looking at Conrad, the lions and the tigers would pace around and around and around endlessly. I mean, if you stood there for an hour, they would just keep pacing from one end to the other, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth all day long. And that really disturbed me as a kid, because I thought to myself, well, you know, I can go out and play. I was allowed to roam around the neighborhood and do whatever I wanted to do. But the animals are all caged up just for our enjoyment, just so you can stand and look at them, because most of us don't get to go on a safari. This is the only way you're really going to see them in person. And yet it is disturbing to see animals caged up like that. Now, of course, this was back in the 50s. today, and at least in some major cities, some zoos have upgraded from that, and now animals are in a more natural setting. Not all zoos. There's still plenty of them around in which that's not happening. And there was also, in the zoo that I visited, there was a place where it was actually a primate house. It was a building. And people called it the monkey house because that was what was in there, all kinds of different monkeys. And you'd go through it, and by the time you got to the end of it, the big display was they had two gorillas in there in different cages, in glass cages. And I can remember that both of them were always, they weren't together, they were separate cages. If you walked up there, they were always sitting in the corner, looking very forlorn, looking down at the floor and looking about as miserable and as unhappy as any living thing could possibly be. Every now and then, they would go berserk and start running down a cage and banging on the glass and all of that. But that was supposed to be a lot of fun to see that, but somehow it wasn't fun. So, you know, I think that is what this episode is really about. I agree with Ken and with Robert about Susan Oliver, but, you know, it's about being trapped, about not being able to get out and not being able to go anywhere, not being able to breathe. Doesn't matter. In today's world, I mean, we've got television, cable TV, DVD players, computers. You can travel the world, without even leaving your room, and yet that doesn't really replace the ability to be able to go outside or get in your car or drive somewhere or take a vacation or do anything. And I think that's really what this is about. It certainly is suggesting that there's a bad part of us, and that is that we don't want to be trapped, but we don't mind trapping animals and trapping other things and keeping them under wraps or in cages for our own private amusement. People are like, well, every time you go to another planet, guess what? They're doing the same kind of thing, only now they're doing it to us. And that's what strikes me about this episode. Of course, it's a classic episode that goes without saying. And I think it reminds me a lot of the monsters who do on Maple Street with the inability of knowing that there's something wrong but not being able to put your finger on it. Just like the people in the neighborhood were running around and the lights were going on and off and nobody understood, so they started to turn on each other. This was kind of the opposite of that, where everything to Conrad looks fabulous. He's got a house, he's got something to drink, he's got cigarettes, he's got everything he possibly needs, and yet there's something really wrong, and it turns out that there's something wrong, all right, that there's aliens that are making trouble. So that's the part of the episode that really strikes me that I find the most interesting. But I have a question for Ken, because Ken and I do both go back to the fugitive days and Susan Oliver, and I know Ken shares with me the belief that Richard Kimball, who walks away from Susan Oliver at the end of the episode, should have just left Gerard dying on the beach so that he could run away with her, but he didn't do that. Okay. So Ken, what do you think? I mean, is it okay to be trapped inside a room or a house for the rest of your life with no ability to get out as long as Susan Oliver spends time with you? Is that enough right there, Lou?
Which is worse, you mean?
No, but I mean, is it okay to be trapped like that as long as Susan Oliver is with you? Then you don't mind.
I tell you, I think that's why this episode works, because the ending is kind of what happens next to Conrad. And the fact that he's in the cage and not being able to roam free, he has the house. But he can't roam free outside the house because he's boarded up. Is that worse? Or watching Tina walk away with a sad look on her face. I mean, he had her in the house. He should have knocked that other guy out. Take a lamp, knock that guy out, keep Susan Oliver in the house, and marry her. And that's what I would have had.
But you've got to understand that Sterling was a pacifist. Okay? No, really, seriously. Rod Sterling was a pacifist. He would not allow much violence in the show.
You're right, because the episodes that are the classics in the series always end with that what if, you know, like in Mirror Image, the guy's running after his double, and it's almost like, what happens next? same with monsters on Maple Street, you know, everyone's running around the street, but what happens to all the characters? It's kind of like you're left hanging, and that's what the lure is. You know, there's many, many more episodes to come, and that's what works for me, and that's the Twilight Zone formula, and that's how you do it. So I'm just a classic.
But there's something odd going on here. I mean, that panel opens up and everybody's standing outside staring at him through the bars. But when he's inside the house in that particular room, before that opens up, there's curtains there that he, I think, tears down.
Yeah, he tears them off.
Yeah, so actually he could have decided when he was going to be seen. He could have just pulled the curtains over himself. In other words, he had actual control whether or not they were going to look at him in the cage, because he had curtains there. They left them, which surprises me that they would leave curtains there, so that he could close them and say, "Well, I don't want to be stared at all day, so I'll just close the curtains."
He didn't know what was out there.
But I'm saying, you know, he could have put the curtains back up and at least controlled whether or not he was going to be seen. It would seem to me that if they were trapping him in the cage, that they would, then not provide any way for him to cover himself up. So that was a little odd right there.
Well,
but I think the story is just about whether mankind has to have his freedom and cannot, because it's obvious they give him what he wants, what they think that humans want more than anything, to be happy. And it wouldn't be enough. I don't think Susan Oliver would be enough or anything would be enough. Everybody needs their personal freedom. You need to be able to decide
that
you're going to go out one day and go and not have anybody say you can't go. It's just simple.
What's the saying, even a gilded cage is still a cage?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you guys think about the high five they gave each other after he said he liked what they did. It was kind of a high five. A little hand touch there.
You know what? I want to hear what Dave has to say about this.
Okay.
Dave, are you there?
Yep, and that was marvelous that he said that, because a gilded cage is still a cage is my first comment. But I think it is an excellent episode. But one of the things I thought really great about this episode, and nobody's mentioned it yet, is the music. It's amazing what they can do with what seemed to be quite a restricted budget, because, I mean, there we are, it's Spaceman, you know, going to another planet, but they did it very efficiently, very effectively, but yet very modestly with the budget.
I never thought about that. You're right.
I mean, I think Twilight Zone, I never know whether its strength is its weakness or its weakness is its strength. And by that, and I've applied this to the other ones that I talked about, the Long Live Walter Jameson and The World of Difference from a fortnight ago, your last show. The very brevity of the show, in a way, means they've got to cut to the chase. They've got to really hone down everything so that the whole story is encapsulated in a very easily understood format, with usually the surprise or the denouement or whatever they want to call it at the end, where, you know, it's leading up to it, and as people have said, it's only, he actually, I think he's in the kitchen, he has the drink, and he thinks, oh, what's out this back door? And the back door doesn't open. Then his mind starts ticking over. Remember, he's not an astronaut, he's a scientist, you know, so he sort of thinks, well, that's unusual. Then he thinks, hang on a minute, this is not ringing true. And it's that when he rushes back into the room, tries the front door, and then, as we've said, in desperation, then tears down the curtains. So, and it's only at that point you realise that he's now classed as a subspecies, really, and where we would put an ape or a primate in a zoo, you've got to then decide, I don't think they quite clarified this so much as whether, you know, he was there because they considered him inferior, because earlier on in the story they're talking to him quite, you know, almost on an equal basis. They seem to acknowledge that, you know, I mean, let's face it, they haven't travelled to Earth. We don't see anything of their city, but we have to assume that their technology is superior to ours. But in actual fact, one would assume that, you know, this creature, to them, has managed to cross space in a highly refined machine, a rocket, yet they still consider him as being, you know,
inferior.
Something. Yeah, yeah. Like we might look at something in a petri dish, they have him in a cage. But I mean, that's the whole point. As I said at the beginning, the brevity of the Twilight Zone means that they have to sort of go right to the nub of the story. And the nub of the story, as I think very eloquently other people have said, you know, a gilded cage is still a cage. He was obviously smitten by that Susan Oliver, and I must admit, who wouldn't be? Unfortunately, of course, she's on the other side of the bars, which means, well, my prognosis is, you know, within 6 months of that, he will have topped himself, but that's not the sort of ending you want on a show like this.
Really needed a line like, you know, I'm not an animal, I'm a human being, and a Charlton Heston moment he really needed,
like
when
Elephant
he realized
Man.
That.
Elephant
yeah.
Man.
Yes.
I'm not an animal. Yes.
Or even The Prisoner, I'm not a number.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Elephant Man, I'm not an animal. Yeah.
But I did enjoy it. But I thought the music played a great deal. I mean, where things actually weren't happening on screen in terms of money and expense and whatever, the music said it all.
Isn't that always the case in a low-budget show like that? I mean, and don't forget, he only had one composer do the whole series, you know, from episode one to, what was it, the third or fourth season?
Well, that's staggering, because it really gets you going. I mean, all the emotions are there in the music. I mean, let's face it, there was a pretty small cast, and we only had about four sets in the whole episode.
Yeah, because all the other people were extras. I mean, they were just extras. I mean, they probably got paid like 20 at that point, at that time period. They probably got paid like $25 each to show up in that episode.
Yeah.
Because there were only a few people that actually were part of the episode, and the rest were extras.
They could have been even crew people that put on the togas and just stood around.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of it just depended on the script itself, too. I mean, you know, we're right now towards the middle of the first season here, and, you know, heading towards the end. And you know, you see some of the scripts are getting better. With some of the episodes as well, especially down the line.
Hey, Robert, what is it going to take for you to give a classic rating to one of these stories? I mean, you keep giving out fours. When are you going to give out a five?
I think I did give a five out on one of them,
He did.
Which one?
Yeah.
Which one?
Wasn't it Monsters? Was it Monsters?
No, I can't remember offhand. There was one that I did give a five to. I normally would give a 4.5. This, to me, would be more of a closer, as I said, what Monsters are due, like a 4.5, closer to, you know, 5.
Well, Time Enough at Last.
Yeah, that's, I think, the one I give
a
5 to. Yeah.
Oh, well, that would be a 5. Yeah, that's a 5 for everybody except for one person. One person rated it below a 5.
Yeah, because I think that was a best script. Now, Burgess Meredith makes other appearances, and I think he was the one most actor that appeared in the Twilight Zone series.
Five episodes.
And I think that was one of his best.
But him and Jack Klugman were the only two actors that appeared in 5 different episodes of Twilight Zone.
And I liked him in when we get to the fourth season, the printer, Devil's Printer, or... the Owl Long one.
Yeah,
that was one of the best ones. I liked the Burgess there, but that is a classic, that one. But unfortunately, I am very picky on, and I imagine you guys are as well, on what you like.
I wanted to ask everybody, what about the space again for the 7th time? Are you guys getting tired of space, or can you put up with it?
It's a Final Frontier.
Well,
did you remember?
I can put up with it only because I've seen some episodes from the second season that are actually good. The one with Eli Whitney. Is it Eli Whitney? or what's his name, Whitman?
Wallace.
Don't
Eli
you think
Wallace.
Rod Serling...
Bob, help me out here.
Eli Wallace.
Don't you think Rod Serling, though...
That is an outstanding episode. So that's a space episode, and I can deal with that. But
isn't he overdoing it, Rod Serling? I mean, come on. This is the first season. You've got 36 episodes, and he's done 7 space stories already.
I know. Did Carl Sagan overdo it in his life?
That's about right to me.
Carl Sagan wasn't a writer.
He's written a lot of books about space, but I don't know what
he's
done.
But he wasn't a TV writer.
Well,
yeah.
I think Rod Serling had a fascination with space.
Robert, can I stop you for a second? It's yeah. Rod Serling.
Rod
not
Sterling.
Rod Serling. It's Rod Serling. You keep saying Sterling. You can't be a host of the show unless you get his name right. Serling.
Sterling.
Okay, all right. Now you're cool.
Okay. I pray that was potatoes, tomatoes to me, unfortunately.
Could you be self-trolled off, Robert?
You can't
yeah.
get Rod Serling. What would you say, David?
No, it's Serling.
I still
yes.
can't say Josh Whedon, so, you know, get on me on that.
Well, yeah. you got to get his name right. It's Serling, not Sterling.
I'll just say yeah. Rod, then.
You
then
keep
I'll
him
say,
in
you
line,
Rod.
Right?
You can say Rod.
Quite right.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to get his damn name right, or you can't be on the show. I know.
Oh,
ah,
my.
Robert, we love you no matter what. No, it's all right. It's okay.
All right, Lynn, I think we've done this to death. Why don't we wrap it up?
Yeah.
Wait, no.
What?
Rick,
yes.
Do you have anything else to say?
No, but what's how does the rating system work?
Well, it looks like mostly classic ratings on this one.
I think he means out of. It's out of 5, isn't it? I think that's what he
yeah,
wants
pretty
to know.
Much.
What's
I,
the number? Up to 5?
Well,
5,
Robert
five being the best? 5
sorry?
Being the best? 5 being the best?
5 is
yes.
the best.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll go 4.5.
All right, that's fine. That's what Robert gave it, and that's cool. I mean, sure. Everybody has their own opinion, and that's fine. You know, because, you know, you can't say, oh, well, you must rate this a classic because, you know, you have to rate it the way you feel it deserves to be rated. Because, you know, if you don't, then you're just going along with everyone else. So
And I agree with Time Enough at 5. I mean, every year,
definitely. Yeah.
Every year I see it during the New Year's marathon, and every year I cry at the end.
Yeah.
That is my most favorite episode of all the Twilight Zone episodes. Time Enough Alas is my absolute favorite.
Yeah. And you know, Lynn, to put a plug in for our book, Volume 1 of the Twilight Zone Revisited and Reviewed, we put a picture of Burgess Meredith on the cover staring at the clock.
Oh,
so
yeah.
let's put a plug in for our book.
Yeah, you can buy it on Amazon, Borders, and is it Barnes & Noble as well?
Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
Barnes & Noble. You can buy our book. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to getting it, too. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And one last question. Rick, where are you from?
I'm from New York.
You sound like you're from England.
Nope, I'm from New York.
Oh, you have almost an English accent. Like Dave, not quite as good as Dave's, but close to it.
Poor lad.
Must
well,
be my
well,
allergies.
Dave, you have the best English accent of all. I mean, my God. If I wasn't marrying Bobby, I'd be falling in love with you. So don't do
it. What's the
a
next
Manchester
show,
man.
Lynn? Hey, Lynn, what's the next show we're doing?
Oh, jeez. Actually,
Bob, do you have that?
I don't know it offhand, no.
All right, hang on. I'll tell you in one
execution.
Second.
Execution?
Execution, yes. Yeah, thank you. Yes, execution.
Now, you see, you getting me with the wrong name there and don't know what the next episode is.
Nope.
Is that your
it's only the episode. I mean, it's not the guy who wrote it's name.
He was executed after he wrote it.
No, it wasn't. It went out the list till 1980.
Execution's our next episode, and that's I forget who stars in it. That's
Albert Selmy. Albert Selmy.
Thank
Albert
you, Selmy, Albert
yeah.
Selmy. Thank you, Bobby. Albert Selmy. Yeah, he stars in that, and that actually wasn't a bad episode. The guy from Gilligan's Island, the guy that played the professor, is in.
Yeah.
Russell Johnson.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, don't ask me to remember their names. I don't remember their freaking names. But anyway, I know that he's in it, and it was not a bad episode. It wasn't. I would never give it a classic.
Well, let's not talk about it today.
No, I don't want to talk about it today. I'm not talking about it today. But no, that is not a classic episode at all. But anyway, does anyone else have anything to say?
Nope.
Nope, great show. Thanks, everybody.
Okay, well, then we are out of here, and we will see you in 2 weeks with Execution.